with is to talk a little bit more about meditation itself. And then I go on to talk a little bit about some of the foundations of the Buddhist practice afterwards, because these things always go together. If you have the right kind of understanding of how Buddhism works, in a sense, and the idea, of course, of Buddhism is that it's supposed to reflect reality, reflect how things actually are. And the more you see things according to reality, obviously the more ability you have to practice that and to kind of put that, you know, make that work for you in your ordinary life or your meditation life or whatever it is. But first of all, I want to just continue a bit about more about meditation, where I left off last night. And one of the kind of main meditation techniques that the Buddha talks about is the mindfulness of breathing, which basically means following the breath, and allowing the breath to kind of take you into deeper states of unification of mind and bliss and all of these kind of things. That's the idea. And I didn't really say much about that yesterday because I wanted to just lay the foundations, first of all, how to kind of get to the point where you can do the mindfulness of breathing. And one of the ideas on the Buddhist path, one of the things that the Buddha emphasizes again and again, is that before you actually get to your meditation topic, whether it's mindfulness of breathing or it's metta, like loving-kindness meditation or whatever it is, before you get there, you have to establish the mind in the right kind of attitude or in the right way. And the right way of establishing the mind is to give rise to this idea of mindfulness again, being present both in time and in space in this particular moment. And this is kind of the foundation for all meditation, regardless of what it is that you do. So this is so important because people often tend to go to the very common to go to the breath straight away and hold on to the breath. And very often what happens if you do that is that it is not comfortable. You don't really feel at ease because you have to use, as I said yesterday, a certain amount of willpower to be able to do that. So getting the foundations right is so important. And for some of you, this may work out very nicely. Some of you are probably quite experienced in this meditation business. And if you are, you will kind of just sit back and you will relax and mindfulness will arise and then the breath will kind of come into view and then the breath meditation happens. And it's like a nice flow. This is kind of the idea with meditation. It's supposed to be a nice flow where things go easily, nicely, where you feel at ease with yourself and things kind of move forward in a natural progression. So if you can do that, it's wonderful. And you just relax and you don't do anything and you just move on like that. But for many people, this is quite difficult. It's not really difficult, but it's just that the mind is conditioned in a different direction. So it doesn't really happen that way. The mind kind of starts thinking about things, and then you don't feel that you're going anywhere. And you wonder, don't I need some kind of anchor, something to hold on to? Otherwise, my mind is just all over the place. So for many people, it doesn't happen quite in that way. So if that is the case, then sometimes it is useful to use other little techniques to kind of help guiding the mind a bit more to start with in the beginning here. And one of these techniques which I really would recommend you to try out is walking meditation. Apparently it's going to be quite hot today, so I'm not sure how good it's going to be to walk, but you can try these rooms, these little halls that we have here. They were originally built specifically for walking meditation, these halls on the side there. And there is aircon in there, isn't there? So you can even turn on the aircon, I think. I think it's aircon, I'm not even sure now. That shows. I think there's aircon in there, so you can turn it on, and then you can kind of be a little bit cool if you have to, because if it's over 35 degrees, it's kind of, at least outside, it becomes quite unbearable sometimes. But walking meditation is very nice because it is more free. It is not as intense sometimes as sitting meditation. It's easier to, especially if your mind is a bit restless and doesn't want to settle down, then walking meditation can be very useful. So how do you do this? And the basic idea is just to have a kind of path, which is usually the length, maybe something like around 30 steps, roughly, and with a kind of fairly clear beginning point and a clear ending point. So you can put down maybe a little rock on either end or just have a natural ending, whatever the natural kind of length is, and you use that as a walking path. A fairly even piece of ground, yeah, is nice. And if you look around Jhana Grove, there's lots of beautiful places to go walking meditation. You have all the gravel roads around here. You have all the paths everywhere. And if you explore a little bit, I'm absolutely sure you find a very suitable place for doing walking meditation practice. And then you set up this path of about 30 steps, starting in one place, ending in another place. And then just walk naturally between those two points. Yeah, and I really recommend it. This is what I learned from Ajahn Brahm. So everything I say is just kind of regurgitating Ajahn Brahm's instructions. I hope you don't mind. I've been brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm, so now I'm trying to kind of brainwash you in turn. Yeah, that's how it works. Brainwashing kind of passed on from one generation to the next one. So, and he says the best way to do walking meditation, I think I can't see that there's anything wrong. I think to me it makes perfect sense, is to walk at a natural pace. And the reason is because when you walk at a natural pace, again, there's nothing forced. Yeah, you are just being yourself, you're allowing things to be, you're not trying to do anything specific. So it's easy, it feels natural. You can be at ease while you do this. So I tend to follow that kind of instruction. And so you walk, start at one point, go to the other one, walk at a natural pace. And then what you do as you do that, you can do a number of different things. One of the strange things when you read the word of the Buddha in the suttas, he says that the monks or the nuns were walking back and forth. He doesn't talk so much about meditation practice for lay people. He talks about it occasionally, but not that much. Usually the instructions are to the monastics, but they can be extrapolated as being, of course, the same for everyone. He doesn't give any particular topic of meditation. He just says they're walking back and forth. So basically what that seems to mean is that any topic of meditation is acceptable when you walk. Yeah, so the classic one that is often used, especially in the Thai forest tradition, which is where Ajahn Brahm obviously came from, is to follow the movement of your feet. Yeah, feel your feet as you walk along. And follow that movement of the feet. And it's astonishing how much good meditation you can have just by feeling your feet, yeah, and how powerful that can become. And Ajahn Brahm is a classic example of this. He talks about his meditation experiences in Thailand. And he said that when he was walking meditation, he became so peaceful that kind of his perceptions got completely inverted. And that is quite astonishing because the place he was doing walking meditation in Thailand in the early days was this meditation hall that was built by the local villagers. And the local villagers in Thailand, they were very helpful and very keen to support the monastery. But they often didn't have the practical skills to kind of lay concrete in the right way and that sort of thing. So the concrete, according, I don't know if Ajahn Brahm is exaggerating or not, probably is exaggerating a bit, because as he says, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. That's Ajahn Brahm's, kind of one of his mottos. But anyway, he says that the concrete in the main hall was like this. It was really kind of bumpy and very kind of rough and really interesting because it was done by the local villagers. They had no idea how to lay concrete. They weren't concrete workers. But he said that when he walking meditation in this concrete hall, where the concrete was so rough, the concrete would kind of, after a while, the concrete would become this amazing kaleidoscope of colors and shapes that would kind of come out at him. And that was because of the stillness of the mind. When the mind becomes very still, it becomes very creative and powerful. And you see things in the world that otherwise you would never see. So this is kind of the idea of walking meditation. You focus on your feet. You allow your samadhi to become powerful through that experience. Your mindfulness becomes strong. And then suddenly all these amazing things come out. Most people would say concrete is ugly. But Ajahn Brahm says concrete is so beautiful. This has certain drawbacks, I have to tell you. The drawbacks of that is that our monastery has more concrete than any other monasteries in the whole world, I think. We have concrete paths going everywhere because of Ajahn Brahm's love of concrete. He has this beautiful perception of concrete. So it's kind of nice, but it also has certain drawbacks. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked as usual. So you can focus on your feet, and it's astonishing how powerful meditation can become simply by focusing on the feet. So this is the first one. So you walk back and forth and you feel, you follow the movement of your feet as it touches the ground, as a foot lifts up, the next foot goes, actually that's the first one that must go down first of all, then the next one goes up, and then that one goes down. And you follow this, the whole motion as you move along, every bit of it. And as your mindfulness improves and your samadhi improves, you will be able to see more and more of that movement of your feet, and your focus becomes more and more stronger. But remember, don't force this. Allow it to be natural, because then that's when it has the best, the most benefit, and it is the most, you feel the most at ease and most comfortable with the meditation practice. This is one way of doing it. But what you can also do, and this is one thing I learned from one of the famous Burmese meditation masters who sometimes comes here to Jhana Grove, and he said that when you do walking meditation, sometimes you have been sitting for a long time and you feel a bit kind of, you want to move your body a little bit, and maybe you had enough of kind of trying to focus on things. So sometimes when you walk, all you have to do is just walk back and forth without focusing on anything in particular. Just enjoying the peace of the forest, enjoying kind of the nice weather, at least now in the morning it's really nice out there. And just enjoying the walking back and forth and feeling the peace. And just maybe observing your mind a little bit. What is my mind doing here? Where are my attachments? Where are my kind of defilements, the negative aspects of my mind? Getting to understand yourself a little bit. And as you come to understand yourself more, this actually is very, very useful to understand our psychology better. Because once you understand that, you understand what might be blocking you in your meditation practice. Once you understand the blockages, you can do something about it, and then you may be able to move on. So just walking back and forth, watching your mind, see what the problem is. And I will talk more about this later on, how to overcome these problems in meditation practice. But for now, just get to know yourself a little bit better. Very often in ordinary life, we tend to react to circumstances. And when you react to the circumstances, often it's very hard to have enough awareness of yourself to be able to know exactly what the problem is. But here, in a place like Jhana Grove, much more ability to see things as they are, rather than just reacting to external phenomena and whatever it is. So walk back and forth. Just be with yourself. Feel the peace. And as you feel the peace and you observe your mind a little bit, there comes a point when you want to maybe come back into the meditation hall, and you come back here, and then you start watching the breath, and things start to come together because of that. So that is a second way of doing the walking meditation. The third way is to do things like metta. Metta is a word which really means something like friendliness, often translated as loving kindness into English. But the idea is just to have a friendly attitude towards other beings and other people or whatever there is. And this is also something you can do on your walking meditation. Just kind of wish other beings well, wish everyone here well, wherever it is, and then build up a kind of positive energy inside. And when you have that positive energy inside, that is really where good meditation, one of the foundations for good meditation to be possible. You can also do other things. You can do reflections on your walking meditation. You can reflect about things that bring you into the present moment. One of the reflections that I sometimes do, some people find this really grotesque and terrible, but it's actually one of the really foundational spiritual things to do, and you will find that in almost all spiritual traditions that people reflect on these things. That is reflecting on death. If you don't like it, don't have to do it. But if you find it useful, and I think it can be useful for most people, if you do it in the right way, remind yourself you're going to die. And there's something very powerful about that. When you know you're going to die, it makes the present moment, the fact that now is the opportunity to do something with your life, it gives so much more value to the present if you remember you're going to die. If you have this underlying feeling, and this is part of the problem often with our lives, there's an underlying feeling that we're going to carry on without limit. There's no sense that there is a limit there. Then there's also no sense of urgency in the present moment. You don't make the present moment special. But if you know that you can die, not only can die, that you will die, and that you have no idea when it's going to be, it makes the present far more interesting, far more important, and it makes the desires and the ideas about the future far less interesting, because who knows what the future has in store for each one of us. So that is a little bit about walking meditation. I would really recommend you try it out. It's a great alternative to sitting meditation. A bit more movement, a bit more ability to use the mind, which is kind of which is very, very handy sometimes. So that is one aspect of meditation practice. Another thing, another aspect that I was going to talk about very briefly is the idea which many meditators teach, and that is the idea of doing body sweeping, focusing on different aspects of the body. And again, the idea is that if you find it hard to just enjoy being here, just sitting back, relaxing, it is a bit more active. You're doing something. And to do the body sweeping technique, then very often the starting point is very often just to sit down, as I was saying yesterday, just feeling the body, feeling what the body is like, and to start off with a kind of general awareness of the body. And when you have a general awareness of the body, you may find that there are certain parts of the body that are a bit more tight or a bit less relaxed or whatever. So you start off with that, and you start off with those parts. And sometimes all you have to do is take a few deep breaths, or you have to kind of just have a more sense of gentleness and kindness in your mind or whatever it is. And then with that general awareness, just allow things to become more at ease and more relaxed with a kind of general focus on the body. This is really the first point, it's allowing yourself to relax properly with the body. And you will find there are certain areas of the body which tend to be tense. It can be the stomach or the shoulders or the face perhaps. These are kind of classical areas that tend to tense up if we have stress in our lives. And then once you have done that, to continue on with the same practice, you can then be more systematic in how you do the body contemplation. And you can actually sweep the body, starting with, from the bottom, if you like, starting with your toes, and then moving up gradually, feeling the body part by part, all the way up. And then as you feel the parts of the body, you feel whether there's any problem there. Even if there's only a small problem, a little bit of pain, a little bit of tension, whatever it is, then you focus a little bit on that area. And as you focus on that area, and your focus should be a kind one, with gentleness, with a sense of compassion for yourself, as you do that, then if you get it right, you will relax, and things will become more at ease. Then you move up to the next part of the body. You move up your leg, and you see if you can feel the various parts of the leg. And you move up all the way, eventually reaching the top of your head, going through every part of the body. And when you focus on these parts of the body, it's important not to focus too forcefully. It's not a bad kind of a very strong focus. It's more like a relaxed focus where you're standing back a little bit and you're seeing kind of an overall picture, but you have that part of the body is kind of a central part of that overall picture. The idea is it's a relaxed kind of attention, not a forced attention. If you force the attention, it is very likely that the tension in the body will become worse rather than better. So you stand back a little bit, you have a general awareness, this part of the body is at the center of it, and then you have a sense of kindness, compassion, and care. And as you do that, things calm down, things become more easy. It's a bit like you can imagine maybe seeing a sunset or something. And this is kind of one of the tricks about meditation practice, is to kind of know the attitude that you have. So imagine you're watching a sunset. Now, one of the reasons why you're watching a sunset, well, you're watching it because it's beautiful. You have all the nice colors, you have a few clouds or whatever. Most people would find a sunset beautiful. But when you watch a sunset, you don't have to force your attention on the sunset. It kind of is natural. And it is natural in part because it is something attractive. It is delicious. Not delicious is the wrong word. It's delightful. It's probably a better word. So you are naturally attracted to it. And this is kind of exactly the same idea as you have with meditation practice. If you're going to watch the breath, or if you're going to watch even the parts of the body in this way, it is important to do it a little bit as if you're watching a sunset. Not grasping on to that image that you're seeing, but it's more like standing back and just enjoying what is going on and having a positive feel towards it. Yeah, this is kind of the idea here. So, and then by doing that, gradually moving through the body, you start to relax more, you start to feel more at ease, and you start to actually emerge into the present moment as a consequence of that. And a lot of this is the idea of having, when you have something to focus on, you don't think about the past, you don't think about the future, and by not thinking about those things, you're not reinforcing those ideas. And when you don't reinforce those ideas, they tend to fade away. Also, it is about learning to have the right attitude. Yeah, you learn to be gentle and caring and these kind of things, and these are kind of essential attitudes for meditation practice, that gentle, caring nature inside. That is where, kind of, again, where meditation happens in a sense. So try that out if you find that useful. Another way, which I will maybe talk about very briefly now, and I will maybe add a little bit more about this later on this afternoon, and that is you can use also metta meditation, the idea of loving kindness or friendliness. And that also is a bit more active than just being passive in the present moment. Yeah, and it can again help you to overcome problems and overcome kind of the forces of the past, which tend to kind of make themselves felt in your meditation practice. So again, the idea of metta meditation is really just the idea of wishing other beings well, having a positive outlook towards people in the world, towards animals in the world, towards any beings in the world, a positive outlook where you wish others well. Yeah, you feel good about others. And it is often very useful to, you can do this in many ways. And of course, I always recommend people to wish everyone here well, yeah, who you will hear. Because as I always like to point out, people who come on meditation retreats are good people. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. Yeah, gangsters don't usually come to meditation retreats. You know what I'm saying? Usually you have some kind of positive thing you want to do with your life. Otherwise, what's the point of coming to a meditation retreat? So these are good people. Yeah, remember that. And when you view your fellow meditators as good people, wow, it really gives you a boost in your meditation practice straight away. You feel really positive about the people around you. And even if they irritate you a little bit, which is unavoidable sometimes when we live close to each other, we always irritate each other. It's not anyone's fault. It's just the nature of human beings, how we do things. But if you see people as largely good, those irritations will vanish like the morning dew on the grass will just be gone, bang, straight away. So this is the starting point. But it's also useful to have a general sense of goodwill towards everyone in the world, not just to the people you consider as good. And I will talk more about later on how to do that. It's very easy to get upset with people in the world because it seems like they're doing all kinds of bad things. But actually, there's ways of dealing with that where you can even have compassion for the people in the world who may seem really careless or even bad or even evil sometimes. You can have compassion for those people as well. But to avoid sometimes the kind of the personalities and all of those things, sometimes you can just have a sense of metta for the various directions. Yeah, like you have a sense of metta to the north or to the south or to the east or to the west. And you just visualize these directions and you visualize all the goodness that exists in all the beings who live like to the northern direction. And there is a lot of goodness in this world. Sometimes when you watch the news or you read about the news, you think that everything in the world is bad. But that is because the news are a distillation of all the badness in the world, distilled into 20 minutes or whatever it is. I'm not sure how long the news goes on for, but whatever it is, it's all the bad things in the world are distilled into one kind of segment. And then we start to think that the world is a bad place. But actually, that's not really true. Yeah, when you come to a place like this, you realize there's a lot of goodness in the world. And so remember that out there, ordinary people who go about their ordinary lives, actually, very often they have a lot of positive spiritual qualities. And of course, from a Buddhist point of view, not only do you have people, you have other beings, often beings who have developed positive qualities to a far greater extent, and because of that have been reborn in even a kind of higher dimension, if you like, or plane of existence. They're just like us, except that they have even more good qualities. And when you remember that, actually, it's quite wonderful to be able to share this world with so many good beings. And then you develop this positive attitude. And as you do that, you're building up positive feelings inside of yourself. Then when you build up the positive feelings inside of yourself, you come back to the breath meditation later on, the breath meditation starts to work. Why? Because it becomes more delightful. You're imbuing the breath with all those positive qualities that you bring with you from the previous metta meditation or whatever it is. So this is just some hints as to what you can do. And I will maybe we can do a guided metta meditation later on just to give you some idea of how to go about this in practice. But that is kind of a bit of the theoretical background. So I would recommend you to try some of these things, and see how it works. Remember that at the end of the day, you have to take responsibility for your own practice. You have to know what it is that you need. Have some awareness of what your problems are. And if you feel that you are thinking too much and it's hard to just be at peace in the present moment, try some of these other techniques. If you find that you're having problems with certain people, you have a bit of ill will coming up, try to do some metta meditation. Forgive people, have compassion. Understand that everyone in the world is deluded. We don't know what we're doing. People are blind very often. And very often, the first person they create suffering for is themselves. So in a sense, it's a bit sad in a sense, instead of being sad about it, have compassion for these people instead, who often create so much suffering for others in this world. And in this way, we can overcome any of these negative emotions that block us in our meditation practice. Okay, so try that out. I'm just going to have a little bit of water over here. Someone has very kindly given me water, which is much appreciated. Okay, so now what I am going to, that is the kind of the most practical part of this talk. This is kind of go straight to kind of the ideas of why we are here. But now what I want to talk about is a little bit about kind of the foundations of the spiritual practice. And how the Buddhist path actually works. And one of the things about the Buddhist path, for those of you who've been around for a long time, you will know that the Buddhist path is called the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path are the eight factors of the Buddhist spiritual practice. And this Buddhist spiritual practice takes you from wherever you are now, and it takes you, towards more and more happiness, and eventually the ending of all suffering is kind of the idea of the Buddhist path. Ending all suffering also means the highest happiness. And this Noble Eightfold Path is a path which is each factor leads to the next one. So it's one factor leading to the next one, the next factor leading to the third one, all the way up to the end of the path. In other words, there is a causal connection, if you like, a conditioning process going on from the first factor to the last factor. And as you can imagine, if this is the case, that there is this causal connection between these eight factors, what that means is that the first factor is fundamental. Without the first factor, basically this path doesn't really start properly. It isn't supported properly. Why? Because the other factors depend on the first factor for their existence. So for those of you who are new, some of these ideas may seem a bit kind of strange, perhaps, or difficult to grasp. So please ask questions later on if you have questions about this. But I'm trying to make it simple, because it isn't really complicated. It's a matter of getting your head around it. So the first factor is the most important one, because that is the source, and everything else arises from that. So what is this first factor? And the first factor on the Noble Eightfold Path is what is called right view in Buddhism. And right view is not some kind of imposition saying this: you must look at the world in this way. That's not really what it is. Right view is the idea that there is a certain way in which the world is. The world is in a certain way, and it is not in other ways. Yeah? And the idea of Buddhism is that the Buddha discovered the way in which the world actually is, the way the world functions. This is kind of the idea of the Buddhist path. And of course, if you have this right view, or if you have this right outlook, this undistorted perception, as it is called sometimes in the Buddhist suttas, if you have the right view, once you have that, then you are able to make informed decisions about things. Yeah, you can make decisions about life that are in accordance with reality. If you make decisions that are not in accordance with reality, they're not going to be very good. They're going to be bad. And I'd like to kind of make this very simple a simile for you to show you how that is the case. If you kind of get up in the morning, you're going to get some breakfast for yourself, you want to go down to the shop to buy yourself some, you know, whatever it is that you have for breakfast, maybe some bread or whatever, or some whatever it is that you like for breakfast, but you don't know where the shop is, or rather you think the shop is to the left, but actually it is to the right. That's wrong view, yeah? That's cool. That's wrong view. That's how simple it is. You have wrong view because you think the shop is in one direction, actually it is in the other one. So you walk in the wrong direction, you never get to the shop, you don't get to have breakfast, and that's called suffering. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? If you really want breakfast, if you're really hungry, it's suffering if you don't get it. This is kind of, it's a very small example of suffering. And then you kind of expand this out into your making something that has to do with your whole life, basically. Everything in your life, all the important things in our life, that is a right view writ large. And this is what it is on the Noble Eightfold Path. So that simile gives you the idea that seeing things in according to reality, using that very simple simile, is so important for us to make informed and good decisions about how to live, what is important for us. Once you have right view or right way of thinking about the world, that informs your values in life. Yeah, your values depend on how we think about things. What you value, if you think that, you know, lots of money and status is important, you're going to value that. You're going to act accordingly, and you're going to kind of spend your whole life making a large fortune. And, you know, that's problematic from many, many points of view. But one of the main reasons why it is problematic is not really going to make you all that happy. Yeah, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? We think these things are going to make us happy sometimes, but actually they're not really going to do all that much for you at all. And not only that, but very often as we go through with these things, we also can create a lot of havoc for people at the same time. So it's problematic from so many areas, really. So this shows you how this right view, right thinking tends to lead to kind of right values, what is important for us. And once you have the right kind of values, that starts to have an effect on your priorities. Yeah, what do you prioritize in life? What actually is, what matters to you, where you put in your effort and energy and all of these kind of things. So for this reason, it matters enormously. And also for another reason, one of the interesting things that the Buddha has to say in the suttas is that there's two causes or two sources for meditation to work. And one of those is morality or ethics, the quality of your heart, if you like. And the other one is your view or your outlook. Your outlook matters. Yeah, because it feeds directly into your meditation. And I mentioned that very briefly yesterday. I was talking about prioritizing the spiritual path over the worldly path, getting your priorities right. And if you get the priorities right, these priorities depend on your values, which depend on your views. Yeah, so it all comes back to views. And this is how it feeds into meditation practice directly. So how does this work in practice? And one of the things that I've been talking about recently, which because it has been, I think, quite topical in many parts of the world. I was in Hong Kong recently. One of the things, of course, in Hong Kong, you may have seen on the news, all kind of problems happening in Hong Kong, lots of clashes between people who are, you know, pro the kind of the government in China and then the people who are pro more like the traditional Hong Kong way of doing things. And lots of problems in Hong Kong, very serious problems. Society is really, really divided over there. I could feel it firsthand. It's very hard to see it on the news, but when you go there, you really get the feeling for this. I was teaching a meditation retreat, a bit like here, and I got questions from both sides of the spectrum. Yeah, some people were saying, "Oh, these demonstrators, they're being using violence. You know, this is no good. What do you think?" You have to be very careful what you say. And then the other side said, "Oh, I love this police. The police are really brutal and violent. The police should be protecting the people. They should be leading by example. How come the police are so brutal?" So you got this feeling that in the audience there were people from both sides. And of course, this is the problem. This is how society gets divided, how it gets polarized, and how we end up eventually having all kind of ill will and problems with each other. So you realize that here the solution for a monk like me is not to take sides. I may have an opinion on which side I prefer, you know, whatever, but that's kind of irrelevant. The point is that there is a deeper truth in her, and that deeper truth is the spiritual reality of what is going on, how we can understand humans and society in such a way that you kind of can embrace everyone, even when society is divided. So that was Hong Kong, and of course, it's not just Hong Kong. You look around the world, you know, historically, there's always been heaps of problems in human society, but right now, it seems to be worse than it has been for a long time, with all kinds of problems, with climate change kind of becoming really a serious problem. You see it here in Australia with all the massive bushfires we had in the eastern states, and before you know it, we probably have it here as well in Western Australia. You see it in the political crises around the world. In the US, they have serious political problems. In the UK, they're having problems. And many other places in the same way. The war is still raging, especially in places like the Middle East. And sometimes, you know, when you look at the world like that, you wonder, how do I deal with this? What is the right outlook? How should I relate to these things in such a way that I don't just get depressed and sad and the world is going to the dogs or whatever? And what about the next generation, all of these kind of things? So this is very important. Yeah. And the point of this is that this is kind of pregnant with spiritual significance. And that is what is so interesting about this. Because this is a kind of a, you know, it's almost like a personal crisis if you feel the world is going in the wrong direction. Maybe some of you don't feel that, but maybe some of you do. I don't know. But certainly as I think about the world, I think, gee, I really don't know where this is heading, all of this. So this is very interesting here. And so first of all, obviously, it's not very useful just to get sad and depressed. Not going to get you very, very far. So you want to try to avoid that, although it is maybe a natural kind of reaction by some people, still it is not very useful. The second reaction that is kind of very common is the desire to do something about it. Yeah, help out, see if you can kind of help out by whatever means, by kind of going on marches in the street and protesting or whatever, or writing letters or doing your little part in this whole scheme, whatever it is. And of course you should do that, especially if you feel that this is a serious problem, which it does seem like to me very often, then it is very good to take some action to do that. But again, if you want to take action, make sure you do it in a good way. Yeah, try to do it with a good heart. Try to do it out of compassion for helping the world. Don't do it. Try to avoid doing things out of anger. Because if you do things out of anger, you are destroying your own spiritual growth. And very often, when we do things out of anger, things get distorted. And when things get distorted, then we end up, you know, starting out with anger, and you end up kind of things getting worse and worse until you end up with violence and you end up with all kinds of problems. And then society gets even more polarized and we don't find any solution. So whatever, I must admit, I have a lot of sympathy for people who protest in the streets. I find it really brave of people doing these kind of things, maybe risking imprisonment or whatever. If you really believe in a cause, it's amazing, you know, wonderful to actually take you to that point where you're willing to do these kind of things. But that is kind of not really the point here, yeah, because people might disagree on these things. There is a deeper truth here. And the deeper truth is that things in the world are inherently out of control. And this is really the deep truth. So if you take action, to help out in the world, to do what you think is right, to safeguard the planet for future generations and also for ourselves. Even if you do that, you don't know what the outcome is going to be. If you have too much vested interest in the outcome, that, you know, we're going to solve this somehow or not, then you might get very frustrated if it doesn't work out. And from that frustration, there will then come anger, maybe. From that frustration might come violence. All kind of problems might arise out of that. And because of that, because of you understand that this is the problem, because you understand that the world is out of control, you don't know what's going to happen next, you don't have so much vested interest in the outcome, because the outcome is inherently uncertain. And this is powerful, because what that means is that you start to turn a little bit away from the world. If the world is inherently messy and problematic, if it never has, if there never is a final solution, to the problems of the world, if things never really have a kind of end point that is kind of final and complete, then actually the world is far less interesting, because it goes from one crisis to another one. Things might get better for a while, then they get worse again. We have living through kind of history, especially after the Second World War, which has kind of been, we had improving of living standards, the world has generally been going in the wrong direction, even though perhaps not always. Still, there has been a general feeling of progress, and that can often delude you into thinking this is the way things are supposed to be. Or even if you look over long expanses of history, you get the same feeling. But the reality is that there is no final solution. War problems have always been part of human society. It tends to always get back to that. Then there's peace for a while. Then there is war again. And we just have no idea what's going to happen around the corner. And this may seem very bleak. This may be the kind of reason why people say, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic. Is that right? Is Buddhism pessimistic? This is kind of missing the point. The point is not whether Buddhist, the point is not pessimistic or optimistic. The point is whether it's realistic or not. That is really the issue. Because if you are optimistic but you're not a realist, then that optimism will shown to be false very quickly, and then you will really suffer as a consequence. Rather, the point is not pessimistic or optimistic, but whether we are realistic. And if you are realistic about the world, then you can get some kind of optimism out of that. Because once you see things in the right way, you understand the world as it actually is, then you can act accordingly. Then you might find a solution which is useful. So the point here is that if you kind of get the idea that the world is out of control, you have no idea where it's going to go next, that there is no final solution, that it's just one problem after the other. You solve one thing, there's one more to be solved later on. You lose some interest in that world. And while you still act out of compassion, you understand that ultimately there is only one thing you can do, and that is to practice the spiritual life instead. And the reason is because when it comes to the spiritual life, it is largely about your personal development, about the development of your mind, development of your morality and your kindness in the world. You have some say over that. You can do something about it because it's about you. And you have some control, not complete control by any means, but you have some control over your own mind and your own actions. The world outside, it is really completely out of control. Your say is minuscule compared to the vast forces in the world. So you change your attitude and you start to look at where you can actually do something. So this is what happens when you do this. You're moving away. You're kind of changing your interest. You're putting much more emphasis on the spiritual life and you're losing some of the interest in the world. So this is why this kind of thinking is so powerful. And what this means is that when you come on a meditation retreat, instead of trying to solve the problems of the world, instead of trying to solve the problems of your life, because the problems on the life are really just another aspect of the world outside, relationships, families. It's wonderful to have relationships and families, but also they too are uncertain, just like the uncertainties of the world. It's a similar kind of thing. All relationships must end in separation eventually. That is the harsh reality of all of these things. So you come back to the spiritual path. You come back to the place where you have some, where you know that you can do something. And you work on those aspects that you can do something about. And this is the idea of right view. It changes your direction slightly. You sit down in your meditation. You remind yourself where real value is to be found. And then you lose that interest, at least to some extent, in the world outside. And it enables you to focus in the present moment and to stay in the present moment. And what is so marvelous about this is that as you do this, and as you purify yourself inside, you tend to become more effective also in the external world as well. By having less vested interest, you become more neutral, you become more stable, you have more kindness, you can act from more compassion. And because of that, you have more ability to do something positive for that world. But you never forget that ultimately, ultimately it is out of control. So ultimately you don't have that much vested interest in the world outside. So this is how right view leads to thinking about the spiritual life and thinking about the trade-off between the worldly life and the spiritual life in a kind of more constructive way. And there is another, even more kind of expanded version of this argument, if you like. And this is to think about the way the Buddha or the way Buddhism thinks about history and thinks about time in general. And in Buddhism, we have a very different idea of time or history than you have in the, for example, more traditional Christian tradition or Western way of thinking about things. And in the Western way of thinking about things, you have a linear idea of time. There's a beginning point. Yeah? Traditionally, God creates the universe, and then the universe kind of ends at Judgment Day or something like that. And it's amazing how influential these Christian ideas are on kind of the world which has been influenced by Christianity, which basically is like, you know, the European kind of culture, essentially. Yeah. And of course, also Middle Eastern culture, yeah, Islam is very similar as well. Yeah. So all of that area is influenced by this. And sometimes we don't understand how influenced we are by these ideas. In Asian culture, by contrast, which is influenced by Buddhism and Hinduism and many other things, the idea of time is very different. Time is not linear. Time doesn't start in a certain place and end in another place. Time instead is circular. You go round. Yeah? And especially the Buddha talks about, if you like, evolution. Yeah, things go round. They evolve and evolve and evolve, and they come back again to the starting point, going round and round and round in enormous circles. Circles can be called eons. Yeah, one eon going on. Come to the end of the eon, you come back to the beginning again. Perhaps this is equivalent to like the universe, Big Bang. Yeah, Big Bang starting off, coming back again, coming back to a new Big Bang, and going round and round, and new Big Bangs coming, happening one after the other. And there is a big philosophical implication of this difference in view of time. Because if time is like linear, if there is a starting point and an end point, what it means is that it's as if there is a purpose to things. Yeah, we're all heading towards this end point down the track. Yeah? We're all moving from point A, where kind of everything was created, and we move into the point omega over here, where everything ends. But if this isn't the case, if time instead is round, is circular, coming back to the starting point all the time, what that means is that there is no purpose ultimately. We're not actually going anywhere. It means that things tend to recur. The same problems, the same things come back again all the time, again and again and again. And what that means, it just reinforces this idea that there is no real solution in the problems of the world. Yeah, there isn't kind of anywhere we're actually heading. There is no omega point. There is no, you know, there is no kind of whatever it is that we're going to. We're coming back to the same problems. And again, that kind of puts you off that world a little bit. It puts you off because you realize you can solve problems forever and still it won't really make any difference. Withdraw your interest from that world. And your interest instead comes back to the present moment, to what you're doing now, because this is what really matters. So again, the idea of having right view about things. And we can see how this also taps a little bit into the idea of having some degree of faith and confidence in the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, if you talk about this circular idea of the world, of time, obviously that has to do with some degree of confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. And so there is a degree of confidence also in Buddhism. You can call it faith if you like, at least to start out with. And then as you develop this, it kind of moves in the right direction and takes you towards all of these things. So the idea here is just to think about things in a way that is constructive and that hopefully will lead to something positive both in your meditation practice but also in the rest of your life at the same time, because it gives you a kind of a view of things that is more in accordance with reality. And this is what the Buddha calls the idea of right view. So I'm just saying this just to kind of help you with that very starting point of the Buddhist path. I may talk a little bit more about this later on, towards the end of the retreat, just to give you something to also think about when you go back home. But just see if you can use these ideas at least a little bit. Don't force yourself to think about these things if you think that they are awful and terrible and you think that I'm a completely deluded fool who's giving you these teachings. Because we have different ideas about these things, yeah? It's obvious. But just reflect on them a little bit and see if you can make a little bit of sense of them. And if you can, they may actually be very valuable in your practice on the spiritual path. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I think I've talked plenty enough already. So please keep on enjoying yourself and try out some of the ideas that I have been giving you, if you wish. And if you don't wish, just do whatever works for you. And then we'll see you back here again. Have a nice lunch as well, and see you back again at 2:00 this afternoon.